Well, welcome everybody. This is quite an amazing event we have here. We hoped we'd get a nice crowd, and we did. So thank you very, very much for coming, especially people who came from long distances. There are actually people here from New York City, from Los Angeles, from Boston, from Washington, from Florida, and all of you here from Michigan, we welcome you as well. So we've got a ton of ground to cover and very little time, so I'm going to jump right in. I'm Lee Berry. I'm currently a development director at the Michigan Theater, and here's how this event came to be. So I was among the founders of the organization back in 1975, where there were a dozen of us, and was a co-director along with Mike Rossori in years 2 and 3 through May of 1978. And for those of you who weren't here in the 70s and 80s and don't really know that much, you need to listen, a little touch will give you just a tiny little intro. Eclipse began in 1975. You know, I thought it had kind of ended around 1990. It later has been revealed that it ended in 93. And just today, someone said there was an ARC show in 1995. So I guess it went 20 years.
It's still going on, actually.
It's still going on. There's a show tonight. Hey, before I forget, after this, we're going to get together at the Arbor Brewing Company, and you're all invited. Because 90 minutes isn't enough for this, actually. So we started, and we ended up producing over 150 shows over all those years by some of the biggest names in jazz history. And Eclipse built a national reputation as a high-functioning, well-run organization, and it became one of the places that every jazz artist wanted to play was in Ann Arbor. And Eclipse, all these people and some of you helped make that happen. So last summer, I realized that the 40th anniversary was approaching, and I thought, something's got to happen. I thought, should I wait till the 50th anniversary? Nah, that seemed like kind of an iffy proposition, don't you think? So the other question I asked, were several actually, what was it that we did? Why did it explode like it did? And what did we accomplish? And does anybody remember or care? Well, I think that people remember and care. I think we can answer that question right now. And I think through the evening we'll find out the answers to the other questions. And about the same time, Arwolf got in touch, and I realized that he wanted to do a long-form story for the Ann Arbor Observer about the same subject. And so we got involved in that. And then also at the same time, Michael G. Nastis let me know that SEMJA wanted to maybe do a fundraising event around the release of the new Miles Davis biopic called Miles Ahead. This is like last year. We thought the movie was going to come out in December, and it didn't. It's coming out now. So since Miles Davis was such a huge figure in that era, and since Miles Davis was also a driving force, I think, in the education of most of us, if not all of us, in our transition from rock music to jazz music, we thought, why not try to wrap these two events together and make something special happen? So we hope you agree that's a good idea. So here's what's coming up. First, we're going to set the stage by having a couple people talk about Miles Davis, and particularly his connection to the Detroit area. And then we'll move into the Eclipse Jazz portion. And I want to just take a minute before my time is up to note the two key players in my era. And, of course, the first one is Jimmy Robbins, whose idea sparked the whole thing. He worked with the people at the Office of Major Events to see if there might be a student-run concert program, and they gave him the green light. He called a meeting. The first group of us got together, and we did 5 shows that first season, starting with McCoy Tyner Quintet at the Power Center, November 1975. Turning point in my life. So the next year saw the arrival of Michael Grafsorian, who I would say is the other leading key figure in the organization's history. And Michael went beyond what is it that we're doing, driving down to why is it that we're doing it. And he helped us crystallize a mission, and the mission was to reestablish a tradition of jazz patronage in Southeast Michigan. And so that is the mission that drove us for years, and I hope hopefully you know, through to the end. But we then did 10 concerts that year. The next year, we introduced a season subscription concept, started the Bright Moments series, and produced 18 shows that year. We're students going to school. We did 18 concerts that year in a period of about 30 weeks, and all big artists. Then there was a change of the guard. Neil Scott, Mike Landy came on board. We launched the Ann Arbor, or the Eclipse Jazz Festival in the fall of 1978. And from there, the organization is off and running. So through it all, Eclipse was known for its very high standards and an extraordinary sense of family, which I can see still exists today. And with that in mind, the other 10 people up here all played key roles. Everybody here made it happen. It was always a team effort, and we're so glad everybody's here. So we can only scratch the surface right now, but hopefully this conversation will continue over time. Maybe we'll be doing this again sometime. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Lee Berry. My name is Michael Jewett. I'm the host of 89.1 Jazz every weekday afternoon on 89.1 WEMU. I've been doing that for quite some time, ever since I was a Eclipse Jazz fan. So kind of all steamrolled and all the right things happening. You know, speaking of the right thing, I think Eclipse Jazz was the right thing in the right place at the right time. The era when it started, you had a lot of amazing music going on. And I look back at all the shows that they did. They brought in Weather Report. You had Weather Report, the biggest electric group in jazz. Fusion, they were on Columbia Records, major label, selling lots of records. At the same time, you also had Dexter Gordon, veteran bebop musician, on a major label, on Columbia Records, selling a lot of records, attracting a big crowd. And also in the Ann Arbor community, I think Eclipse Jazz really nurtured the love for the cutting edge of music, avant-garde music, kind of like the second generation of so-called, I don't know if everybody feels comfortable with the term avant-garde, I'm going to use it, but you have these people that came along in the wake of Ornette Coleman and Cecil Taylor. You had the Art Ensemble of Chicago, all the great groups out of Chicago that really found a great audience here in Ann Arbor. And you also had this brewing underground of younger musicians like Wynton Marsalis, this Young Lions generation that came along in the 80s. And Eclipse Jazz presented all of these artists. We were all, blessed to, see these artists grace our stage. You had the right place. You had Ann Arbor, Michigan, a place that was really open to music at that time, open to the arts. It was the right time, just this great era of music. And these people and others, I know that there's some people who couldn't be here tonight, but these were the right people in the right place at the right time who did all this incredible work. So I just want to thank them personally for, enriching my life. I'm sure, if you're here today, they enrich your lives as well. So we owe them some thanks for doing that. And thanks to the hard work, I'm going to give R. Wolf most of the credit. You've been kind of like one of the ringleaders in organizing some of the historical information and whatnot, a document, and looking over this list of all these concerts, I'm like, I was there. I remember that show. I remember missing that show. I'm still mad. I was in the middle of the Reagan recession. I was broke. I could not even afford an Eclipse ticket. Missed all that one show. Anyway, actually, I guess the Eclipse show is one thing to point out. It was very open. It wasn't just a U of M thing. It was a U of M and an Ann Arbor thing. You had really a lot of community support. And I remember Eclipse Joe's shows never felt that they were cost prohibitive. I think you guys did a good job of holding down that cost. So anyway, so thank you all. I'm here basically to just move things along through the program. I think we're going to have people moderate from the stage. If you've got a handheld mic, just pass it to the next person. And we'll just keep it rolling here. And thank you so much for coming out, and thanks to everyone at Eclipse for making this possible. Tom gave me the technical thing on this, so we'll see if I can.
So just turn it on first. Just show me when that light goes on, you're done.
Yeah.
Everybody gets 5 minutes.
If it starts blinking, I've activated something, I'd leave the building. Do I do this?
Yeah, pull the bad one back to five.
Okay.
Go.
Lars Bjorn, please.
The mics are all live.
Thank you. Well, this is a wonderful panel, and we'll probably be done sometime next month, I would think. But I'm here doing many things, but I want to first mention something. I gave this handout to several people already. This is the pre-screening of a Miles Ahead movie that's taking place on Thursday night. And there is a reception, and the movie at 5, and the reception is at 7. And if you're interested, let me know. I'll give you this handout, and that tells you how to get hold of tickets. Because I'm the only one that has tickets left, so you have to talk to me. or email me. I want to talk about Miles in Detroit because Miles spent a lot of time in Detroit. It was kind of his second hometown, if you count, say that New York was his real hometown, even though he was born in St. Louis, East St. Louis. I do want to say a few things about his time in Detroit, because I think it's quite interesting. The first major event, I would say, is when he came with Charlie Parker to Detroit and played with his quintet for 2 weeks at the end of 1947 at the El Cino nightclub in Paradise Valley, which was the entertainment center and business center of the black community in Detroit on the Near East Side. It was located on St. Antoine and Adams. And it's notable because they made recordings there. They recorded four sides for Savoy Records. And that's Miles Davis with, of course, Charlie Parker. And those are fabulous and available widely. Go on YouTube, you can listen to them. Everything is on YouTube. The next major event, I think, is when Miles ended up at the Bluebird for half a year or more in the mid-50s. He came to Detroit sometime in the fall of 53, spent about 5-6 months, then left, and then came back again the following fall. And believe it or not, he came to Detroit to kick heroin. He started the process in his parents' home in St. Louis, and after a week there, he felt he was relatively clean, even though, as I think you'll find out in the movie, it wasn't like that was the only break he ever had with drugs. So anyway, so he comes to Detroit, and he had been in Detroit many times and become friendly with Clarence Edens, who ran the Bluebird on the west side, on Tyerman and Beachwood. And he lived at Sonny Wilson's hotel on Grand Boulevard. And he would walk to the club, which wasn't all that far away. But it was never advertised in 53. He just came in every now and then, depending on how he was feeling. So he was obviously going through a very difficult period. But the musicians remember it. The ones that we know in particular who really talked a lot about it were the piano players. He first played with Tommy Flanagan and then with Barry Harris, who are legendary Detroit piano players. The band was led by Thad Jones. He led the house band there, and it was an unbelievable band, and Elvin, his brother, was on drums. So it was quite an outfit. Billy Mitchell was also in the band many times and sometimes was technically the leader. He was a tenor saxophonist. So those are fabulous days. And I want to tell you about something that didn't happen at the Bluebird, but at another major club. Detroit was really booming in the 50s in terms of jazz clubs. And one of them was the Crystal. And we interviewed for the book I wrote with Jim Gallert called Before Motown, which came out in 2001. And we interviewed Frank Gant as one of the people we interviewed. And he was a drummer. And he saw Miles at the Crystal during this time period. And the band that was playing at the Crystal was the Clifford Brown Quintet. And so he talks about it. He says, I would just read from his interview. Brownie was flawless, in the stratosphere, clear as a bell. And in come the Bluebird people. The people who've been hanging out with Miles at the Bluebird. The barmaid who used to be there came in and says, come on, Miles, get him, Miles, go ahead. You know you can outplay Brownie anytime. So it's kind of a cheering crowd for a support group for Miles Davis, trying to cheer him on. So Miles walked up to Brownie and said, do you think I can play? Oh, yeah. I'll let you play, but why don't you ask Max? Because Max Roach was kind of the leader of the band, so... Max said, okay, come on. And so Miles gets his horn and he walks up. And this is what Gant says. And he walked up, talked to Max and the Cats, and then turns around to the audience and puts the bell of the horn right on the mic. And then he played My Funny Valentine, and you could have heard a rat pissing on cotton when he finished. I thought that was a wonderful expression. So that's the impact Miles Davis had on his audience. And, you know, he played that song and then walked right out of the club. You know, so that was a memorable moment to Frank Gant. And there were many more to come. He came back with his sextet, played the Bluebird. We have photos in the book of the group sitting at the bar at the Bluebird, et cetera, et cetera. So, and Miles, of course, came back many times to Detroit and, you know, delighted everybody. So do go see the movie and come to the reception if you can afford it. Right. We'd love it.
Thank you very much. I'm very, very excited to be here. My name is Reginald Canty. I administrate over a group of bass players that have origins in Detroit. It's called Detroit Bass Players Organization. We have a Facebook page. We also have a website, and I'm the page administrator. We have roughly 1,800 members globally. We started out just a bunch of guys just trying to reconnect after being away for so long. And we saw the interest in other people from other locales who wanted to get in. We just let them in. And some of our members are people that you are really, really recognize, and we're happy because when they come to town, we get to hang out with them a little bit. Talking about Miles Davis in Detroit is a little bit before my era. I'm 63 years old and born in 1952. In 1965, I began to play bass. I realized when I first got exposed to it, I had a facility for it, so I kind of stuck with it. And my brother, 6 years older than me, was a Vietnam veteran. He sent all this stuff from Okinawa home, and he had all these records that you couldn't get in the States, and I had complete works of Miles Davis. I think I was the only person in the eighth grade that wasn't listening to Motown. Everybody thought I was kind of crazy, but I realized that jazz is an art form. It's an artist's interpretations of musical concepts without the boundaries, whereas popular music is a music that's geared to appeal toward a certain group of people for purposes of selling records. And I'm very proud to be a jazz musician because it's America's contribution to the world of art. We are to America what classical music is to the Europeans. And Miles Davis struck me, he still strikes me, he struck me as a person who had an incredible amount of vision. He was probably the major architect and spokesman for jazz during the latter half of the last century. And he managed to redefine and reorganize jazz every 5 years or so. He also managed to bring out the best in the people that that he played with. He sought them out, and he took the handcuffs off of them. And most of what people don't know is a lot of times he never handed people a written piece of music. The writing didn't come down until he had a finished product. And in my experiences with Detroit bass players, I've met Ron's son, Ron Carter Jr. I've met Ron. I've met Stanley Clark, Marcus Miller. And we're all familiar with Paul Chambers. I met some of his people. And it's been a really eye-opening experience for me to be so closely involved with people who are close in his life. I have a good association with Vince Wilburn Jr. in Chicago, who is Miles' nephew and played with Miles on the drums for the last 10 years of his career. And I just finished an 18-month tour with Michael Henderson, and I was really, really, really taken that he would ask me. Of course, he discovered me on Facebook, and he requested me to be in his band, and I was totally blown away to be asked to play bass for a man who played bass for Miles for 10 years. And I think I drilled Michael more about his days with Miles Davis than I did with any piece of music he ever handed me. But it was just so overwhelming to be that close to the true information of the story of Miles Davis. Because, of course, I wouldn't have done some of the things he did with his personal life, but that's not what I celebrate about Miles. I celebrate about his unmatched and probably will never be matched body of work. And I still feel that way today. There's no one that I can mention that can match the body of work that he's left behind us. He was a precious jewel. And the things that I learned from him and from the people who were associated with him, some of his relatives and some of the people that knew him and played with him, was just very, very, very important to me. And I cherish the moments that I spent with those people. We are currently looking at, we have a Bass Day event, and we try to work on the music of certain individuals, and Miles Davis's works will come up very shortly. This is the fourth year we've had a Bass Day event. If you'd like to know more about that, contact me on Facebook. My name is Reginald Canty, and I'll tell you everything you need to know about the things that we do. I appreciate your ears. Thank you very much for having me here.
Yeah, I guess I'm the transitional character. I'm Jimmy Robbins, and I was, a lot of people know me as Max, and we don't have time for that story tonight. But I was really fortunate, really blessed, at the very beginnings of Eclipse Jazz. And really how it started was I had an association with the major events. What's a major events? Yeah, Office of Major Events here. And just, you know, was another kid in college who loved music, loved jazz, loved rock and roll, loved the blues. And I came in, and it was the beginning of my senior year, and I came back. I'd spent a lot of that summer in New York, and Suzanne Young, who was running it, she asked me if I'd ever heard of Bruce Springsteen. And I had just been hanging out with these guys in New York who were Jersey boys, and they were just, it was like religion. And I said, yeah. She said, well, I have an opportunity to book him. Should I? I said, absolutely. And then about a week later, Bruce Springsteen was on the cover of Time and Newsweek. And I came back into the office, and she knew I was a jazz fan. And she said, you know, I'm thinking of, she goes, you seem to know what you're doing, which was a really misconception at the time. I had no idea what I was doing. And she said, there's this jazz concert series over in East Lansing. And I'm thinking we'd like to start one here. Are you interested? And I said, absolutely. And she sent me to East Lansing. I think that the show was, I think it was a Gary Burton show, but don't hold me to it. And I came back here, and we had the first meeting of what would become Eclipse Jazz. Now, I think this gent, Lee Berry, who really deserves a tremendous amount of gratitude, and we had this meeting, and Lee was part of this group, this motley crew, and fortunately, he lived in this house where it was kind of like we could staff the place just by his roommates, you know. There was a lighting person, there was a sound person, there was somebody who was good with numbers. And I think it was Lee who came up with the name Eclipse. The other thing, and somebody who's here tonight, it was just great to see after so many years, a guy named Eric Keller. Eric, can you stand up for just a second? Eric's just an amazing, like, creative director, art director, artist. And he came up with the Eclipse logo. And Eric and I were both students in the residential college, and there was a real kind of what you call now DIY culture, do it yourself. And we had worked together on a couple of other projects. We started this, I guess it would be called now a performance art series. It was a thing called Poetry Works. Eric could kind of take my ideas and his ideas, and he would do the posters for it. So immediately when Eclipse Jazz happened, I said, Eric, you got to do this, which he did. And then I don't even know I thought of this. We were thinking this idea. I knew that major jazz acts were booked at Baker's Keyboard Lounge, which I've been going to since I was underage. And that they would play Tuesday through through Sunday night. They'd come in and say, well, wow, if I call them a day early, maybe they'd like to pick up a few extra bucks and play Sunday night gig in Ann Arbor. And I got the number of Jack Whittemore, who I think was Miles Davis's agent, who was one of two major jazz agents. And I just called him up. I was a kid, and I said, hey, I hear McCoy Tyner's playing, and I can't remember, maybe a month later or something. Would he like to make $2,000 more? Would the band like to make $2,000 more? And he said, sure, kid, you know. And we booked McCoy Tyner. And that first season, as Lee mentioned, we booked an incredible amount of acts. I tried to find him, I couldn't. There was one of the early Eclipse Jazz members was a guy named Austin Sanders. And he and I were both big Cecil Taylor fans, even him more than me. And he just kept pushing me, well, we're going to book Cecil Taylor, we're going to book Cecil Taylor, which we did. But that first Miles Davis gig, I mean the first McCoy Tyner gig, just a very quick story, because this kind of says it. McCoy walks into the Power Center, and there's this white baby grand piano that we, fortunately, somebody in the staff, it wasn't me, had been smart enough to have tuned that afternoon. And I'm standing next to this jazz legend, and he looks at me and he says, what do you think I am, some kind of like honky-tonk cabaret player? I'm not going to play that. If it doesn't work out, we'll find something. I was terrified. And I said, please, you know, just try it. I'll finish in a second. I said, please, just try it, you know. And he sits down, and he plays a couple chords. And I knew this was the piano they used at the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival. I mean, Ray Charles had played this piano. Count Basie had played this piano. And he turned to me and goes, yeah, this will do just fine. So that's just kind of a snapshot of how this happened. And I think what happened later, and a real testament to this organization and all these people here, and some people who aren't here, is that it really, I know in my life, my career, which took a little bit of, I didn't go into the music business, but it really just informed so much of my sensibility. You know, I think of that of, and that I brought to all these facets of my professional life. So it was a real gift. I'm just so pleased to be here with all these wonderful people. And thank you.
I'm Michael G. Nastas. You probably know me from doing radio and writing. My voice is a little shot today because I've talked to so many people about this event. But I want to say the history of jazz in Ann Arbor in the early 70s was a little bit thin. The transition between the University Activities Center and UAC Daystar and the establishment of the Office of Major Events left a void here on the national level. Now, we always had a great local music scene and have always had great local musicians. I had a friend at Michigan State University, and so I would spend every single weekend up there at McDonald Kiva and Erickson Kiva buying records on Grand River. This is preschool kids, although Discount Records and Bonzo Dog Records were selling a lot of retail, but the records were cheaper up in East Lansing. The Showcase Jazz series run by Terry Donaldson was, as Jim said, just incredible. I was at the Gary Burton Show. I saw Carla Bley, the Sun Ra Orchestra, Sam Rivers, and I got to hear Bill Evans shortly before his passing. So that was, to me, as precious as anything. I was the music director of WCBN-FM from the early 70s right up to 1976. And credit to Dave Harney, who is our program director, and Ross Ojeda, who was our general manager. Ross would eventually go on to work for A&M Records and the A&M Horizon label to support artists like Sonny Fortune and Thad Jones, Mel Lewis, and many, many others. Dave went on to Columbia Records. My first interview on the phone at WCBN was Bruce Springsteen. And that was during the Born to Run period. And then Tavi Fulkerson and I interviewed all the Return to Forever members in the studio. I interviewed Todd Rundgren in a hotel, Klaus Doldinger of Passport. It was an incredible whirlwind of a first week as music director. Suzanne Young came to the bowels of the Student Activities Building, and asked if WCBN would be interested in promoting any Eclipse Jazz. At that point in time, we had established a program called Jazz Round Midnight, which was very popular. And unlike any other radio station's jazz programming at that point in time, Tavi Fulkerson did the show. Scott McWinney told me he did some shows. Peter Petto, who's on the panel, Michael Landy. Michael Lang, prior to and during his tenure at School Kids Records. And there were several others that did one show a week and really brought the sound of jazz into Ann Arbor in a way that it had not done so before. We were happy to promote Eclipse. When they told me that McCoy Tyner was the first show, I just jumped for it. I said, this is my favorite guy. You're like setting the bar so high, it's unbelievable. So we continued to do Eclipse Jazz presentations promoted by WCBN. And this is at a time when CBN was transitioning with frequencies and legal stuff and just all kinds of things happening. We also took the block formatting away and established a freeform entity at CBN, but the jazz program stayed as a block, and it was a very successful block. I'm very proud to be a part of Eclipse Jazz on that end of things. Eventually, I did work in the office doing publicity. The people at Eclipse were always open to suggestions and asking us what we thought of bringing Sun Ra and the Bright Moments series and whatever. I got a chance to MC many of those Bright Moments shows, as well as a few from the Office of Major Events. I introduced Larry Coryell opening for Frank Zappa. And Miles Davis's opening act was Pat Martino and Bobby Rose. I did a lot of the Bright Moments shows. Michael Jewett was my main harasser up in the balcony of East Quad. Yeah, you don't remember. Anthony Braxton. But from the art ensemble to Cecil Taylor, the concept of producing more commercial artists so you could do the progressive people was a great concept. Lee talked about the subscription series. It was a fruitful time for jazz in this area. And I also want to make sure that you know that the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festivals of the early 70s were really the seed for what Eclipse Jazz brought. But Showcase Jazz was really the example that we followed. All those years from up to, 1990, great shows one after another, just blows my mind all the great performances that we presented. I'm very proud to be a part of that. Very proud.
So, hello, I'm Tom Bray. The beginnings of Eclipse Jazz. Wow. In case you hadn't figured out, I was one of the production people. That's why I'm making all these things going around here. But the way that this all started from my perspective is that there was this sort of announcement, we're going to put together a student group called the Ballroom Concert Committee, the Michigan Union Ballroom. And the idea was that I heard for that this was Jimmy's idea. Is like, that, you know, everybody can come and make copies and get coffee, but these kids need to do the work in order to learn what this is about. And they're going to make mistakes. So, you know, like, give them $5,000 and let them lose it every year. It's worth it. Well, we went from the we don't know if it's going to work Ballroom Concert Committee to our very first show was McCoy Tyner at Power Center. That was how we got hit the ground running. And it was really interesting. Somebody said the right place at the right time. It really was. So the Union Ballroom is kind of a blank slate. We brought in some sound. We brought in a simple lighting system. Power Center is a major theatrical venue on campus. It's huge. Just so happens, I had been in the lighting design program at U of M, and so I'd been spending many, many, many hours there. I knew the theater really well. It's a complex place to do a concert compared to what normally happens. Here's a funny story. That place was built with serial number 2 of the first ever memory lighting board. Yeah, and it was kind of like Alzheimer's memory. You'd write a cue and it would come back close, you know, but it was, you know, you never knew. But here's the thing about that was different about that is other lighting boards have two scenes. You have like a whole row of controllers for each dimmer, a a big fader, and another row of controllers. So I can set levels on one, set different levels on the other, and fade from one to the other, right? Pretty straightforward. This lighting board had only one controller for each dimmer because it had memory. You don't need to fade from one to the other. So as far as I know, and I don't want to brag if this isn't true, I'm the only person in the history of the Power Center that ever ran that board manually live. It was fun. And I was perfectly comfortable doing it. They thought it was crazy. Nah, this'll be great. But it's because that right place, right time was like what Jim was saying, you could have staffed it at the house. Well, that's part of what was there, just the right people at the right time. It was an experience. I mean, I also just think back 40 years ago, we were kids. We didn't know we couldn't do this, right? Nobody said no, so we just ran with it, and it was amazing. I'm actually very impressed. I was looking through an archive file that Larry brought, and there are job descriptions of different positions in there. I have never been in a real private corporation that has job descriptions that good. And this was a student organization. It's amazing. You know, you could bring anybody in and go, here's what you do, you know? It was a fun time. It was just that time of, yes, let's do more. We can do workshops. We can bring these artists in, and then they can spend time with people one-to-one. We can get people to give us money to do that, right? And we talked about ticket prices. I don't know if you noticed any of the slides up here. Chick Corea and Gary Burton at Hill Auditorium. Tickets, $3, $4, and $5. What? I mean, how can you do that? How can you present that kind of stuff? But we did. It was just an amazing thing. We pulled it off. I mean, people started coming in, and we gave them jobs, and we expanded, and it was really fun. And I'm going to end early, because that's about all I have to say.
Hi, my name's Peter Petto, and I came here to Ann Arbor like a lot of people come to a big college town to learn stuff. And I was at MBA school, at the business school. And just before I came here, I had been at Northwestern University, where a guy named Neil Tesser, who writes a lot for jazz, was the station manager at my radio station. He said, you know, you play this Frank Zappa, and you play this other stuff that's got like syncopation. You have jazz potential. And he just gave me a bunch of stuff to listen to. So at the same time when I came to Ann Arbor, enthused about learning about business, I was also enthused about learning about jazz. And I think that as I look back now at people I see who were, you know, success in some way, that they don't say, oh, I took this class and it was really great, or I did this. They say, I worked for the radio station. You know, the people I know in the news business wrote stuff for the newspaper day after day after day, article after article after article. You know, they were on the debate team, you know, and now they're, you know, reporting on the Supreme Court or something like that. It's the stuff that isn't in the classroom that seems to be where a lot of the learning happens at a college. And I was just so blessed, and I think a lot of people you'll hear say that they were lucky, and how did this happen, and it all happened at the same time, that I heeded this call and came to this thing saying there's a ballroom committee and let's do stuff and it'll have to do with jazz, you know, and I said, well, I think I can do this part of it, maybe one of the job descriptions. And I just remember that committee as being something that everybody there was united by a common vision of that jazz should be elevated. And I remember going to shows in East Lansing, in Detroit, listening to sound companies that were doing stuff. I mean, I wanted to get my hands on sound equipment. I didn't want to just read about it in a magazine. I wanted people like me to be able to play with it and use it and do stuff with it. And it sort of all happened that way. And I remember Eclipse as being something, I mean, other people may have different opinions. I thought nobody was in charge. I thought we got together. Yeah, I thought, well, I went out into the business world later and tried to create organizations where nobody was in charge, or where each person knew their task and had a common vision and just went and did that. Because I remember getting together and talking about, oh, I saw this, you know, they did this at this show, and shouldn't we do this? Or, you know, a lot of different, very particular things that if I went into them, you know, would be too much. But I didn't want to. We wanted jazz to be elevated, and you wanted to be able to go to the bathroom and not be afraid of the bathroom like you were at a lot of places where you went to. and that it would be honored. And I think it worked out that way. That's what happened. The people who did hospitality in a way that really made the artists feel good when they hit the stage.
Charles Mingus is one.
Yeah, it's just so learning by doing was like a big essence, and that's part of what made this all click. The other thing that I think about when I think about a big university town is there's all these different groups of people, and everybody supported everybody else. So maybe you went to East Lansing to score all these records. If Michael Lang at School Kids knew that Eclipse was doing a show and I was doing a radio show and we didn't have enough records at the station and I was going to buy a few, he would say, "We'll sell. You can have all these at cost. If you're going to play on the show and it's going to get people into that thing, mm-hmm. go ahead." And that's the kind of thing it was. The School of Music, you know, WUOM, WEMU, I mean, all different groups of people, you know, sort of supported. I mean, there were people doing other things, not necessarily, you know, we're doing, you know, the Robert Altman Film Festival. I mean, but everybody, like, helped everybody else out in a way that is what makes a liberal arts education college place, all these different things. Why don't you want to go to a massively open online course and just do something on your computer with, like, you know, virtual reality and learn stuff? You do it in a specific place, because all of those things can create sort of a critical mass for the magic to happen, okay? And the magic does happen. That's all I have to say.
You were the guy in charge of everything, right?
Well, that has something to do. Okay, 5 minutes.
I've always had that impression of you.
I'll give him a couple of them.
Yeah. You have my vote. I approve this message. Take away, girl.
Peter and I need to have some memories brought back. So I'm Michael Grufsorian, by the way. Earlier this afternoon, I hunted for the first Eclipse Jazz brochure that I had something to do with. It was printed on yellow paper. And if I remember right, Chick Corea's photo was on the cover. I hunted for it because the Eclipse brochure, as we called it, stated our case to the public. I will find it one day. But for now, I remember very clearly its closing words. Welcome to the music. Those words embodied a lot of things, some of which I must now apologize for.
But you can leave that unsaid.
Oh, no. I didn't come this far not to apologize. One of them was to impose my personal relationship to jazz on everybody else.
Thank you, Michael.
This brought heartache to many people, many of the people gathered here, and particularly to Lee Berry. And for that heartache, you now have my apology. Better late than never. I can only ask, as the song says, to blame it on my youth. I was a young man, and in some ways, and through no fault of my own, not especially well developed emotionally. These limitations and faults, however, crazy they made everyone, were perhaps counterbalanced by the notion that what I recognized in myself was common to those who joined with me in this work. And that was, how on earth could I grow up in Metro Detroit, be a devoted music lover from the age of 10, a University of Michigan graduate, and not know about America's greatest contribution to culture? The answer for me was that something simply had to be done about it. Eclipse Jazz was doing something about it, and I was all in. The way we should measure what we did, in my view back then, and still to this day,
was to match the greatness of the artists we presented. We should be as great in our work as they were in theirs. That's a high standard and a grand vision. Enough to drive anyone crazy. But it seemed the question of whether to act had already been answered. McCoy Tyner, Keith Jarrett, Les McCann. And so we worked like dogs. We were cultural warriors, whether we knew it or not, whether we liked it or not. And the public was waiting for us whether they knew it or not. We addressed ourselves to a question that I have continued to wrestle with for the past 40 years. Audiences are willing to listen. Musicians are willing to sing to them. The two need a bridge to each other. We provided the bridge when others wouldn't. The world remains in short supply of such bridges, to bridge willing audiences and great artists to sit together in moments of beauty and transcendence. Why Eclipse ended, why there are not more, is a very important question, which deserves our attention. But it's great to see everybody tonight.
Good. My name's Neil Scott. I want to echo what other people have said here about I'm very fortunate to be sitting here among everybody else. And this reminds me of a high school reunion you want to go to. Lee mentioned, because he's so damn organized, what he is, Michael. And he said, well, you're going to talk about growth. So, great, growth. And I thought about it a little bit, and I thought, well, there's three areas of growth to talk about. There was growth of the organization itself. There was growth of the people who worked there, and there was growth of our audience. Regarding the organization itself, these gentlemen talked about the beginnings, beginnings, beginnings. From here, it's going to ramp up a bit to a lot different stuff, and the people following me will tell you how they were inspired and how they took that inspiration to move the organization forward. The organization had bright moments, and that the concept for Bright Moments, named after a Rahsaan Roland Kirk song, was for education and entertainment. And that really was a basis for a lot of the things we did. A lot of people got more geeked about the workshops, and the workshops could be anything from Archie Shepp reading a 10-page paper. Sounds boring, but it was fascinating. To Sam Rivers saying, and I think you coined this term, squeaky shit.
Still used to this day.
he walked in and there were other musicians. This was a workshop for musicians. And he said, yes, I can play blues. And played blues. Yes, I can play bebop. And here's some of that. But he played squeaky shit. And he taught the musicians about how he thought about music. And I thought, well, that's a great thing for an organization to do. We were blessed through efforts of other people to get a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. And Michael was on my case a lot, making sure stuff like that was done properly, which is just great. So the organization itself grew, but the people who worked at the organization grew a lot too. I started because I was news director at WCBN. I was doing newscasts there, and I knew this guy, Lee Berry, and he was doing shows, and I didn't have a thing to do on Friday night. And so I went by the Union Ballroom, and Rahsaan Roland Kirk was playing. He said, come right in. And there's a meeting on Thursday. And that's how I started. And I grew in a lot of ways because of opportunity. If Eclipse Jazz offered opportunity to people who wanted it. Tom knew about lights, so if people wanted to come in and learn about lights, about sound, Scott McQuinney will probably tell you about this, about he got to learn how to do stuff. If you wanted to just be an easier member, if you will, non-technical member, you could be on the hospitality committee, and you got to think, how fun was that, picking up some of these people from the airport? And that was, everybody contributed a lot to that. I got to do the first Eclipse Jazz newsletter with help from Lee and with help from Ann Rubentish. And so I remember we had a mailing list of 5,000 people, and we folded them all and mailed them. And we put it all together, and I thought, great, what a great accomplishment. This is wonderful. And Mike said, yeah, now sell ads and pay for it, damn it. But he was right. Okay? I was pissed. But he was right. So we did that, and so as a family, and we're all a family, we grew and had an opportunity to do a lot of things. But our audience grew, too. I'm a little bit older than some panel members here. In 1973, I went to a jazz show in a long-defunct place called King Pleasure. Okay? It was in the basement of a building on Stadium and near Washtenaw, I think. I saw Charles Mingus there, and the room wasn't full. And so, but I was kind of liking this jazz stuff and enjoying, you know, and getting opportunities to see it, and I was blessed to go to New York City and see some people. And but our audience, once we started to do stuff and put shows on, they got into it. Our mailing list grew, as I said, very quickly to 5,000. They got to go to the education time, too, and so I'm going to stop talking right now.
Go a little further. You're doing great.
So I'm Mike Landy. I co-ran the organization with Neil here in the fourth year of Eclipse. Eclipse had a couple of things that were really important to it. One is community, and one is education. And they suffused it in a lot of different ways. So community. Well, first of all, how did I get into this organization? Well, I already love jazz. I was an undergrad in New York, and I that was my, you know, I like a lot of different kinds of music, but I love jazz.
Is that
my call? Yeah, it's on. And so the first year of Eclipse, they're always wonderful concerts. I think I went to nearly, or if not every one of them. Tom was a friend of mine there, go to the last show, and I see he's on stage. I say, Tom, what are you doing? He says, Loadout, you want to help? And I did. So I got to, you know, that's part of the community, because it was a lot of people who knew each other or who became incredibly close friends. A year later, Lee and Tom and I are all living in the same house. So when an Eclipse show happens, we're completely tied in with both Eclipse Jazz and WCBN, the things that basically made all of this run. And it was a community of people who did these things, who worked their butts off for no money, vast quantities of hours. I had this job at the physics department that didn't require me ever to show up, which is how I could work 50 hours a week on Eclipse Jazz for a full year for no pay, which was awesome, and it was a great thing. And there was a community beyond the group because, of course, there was jazz happening elsewhere. There was Showcase, and many of us would go up to East Lansing and see the shows, and we got to be good friends with many of the people up there. And then there were the graduates of these programs that would then provide jazz elsewhere. Think Ypsilanti, the Punch and Judy Theater in Grosse Pointe, whatever. So it became a much wider spread community. And a community, of course, back and forth with WCBN, since half the people in Eclipse were also DJs on WCBN. I was on Jazz Around Midnight the second week I was in Ann Arbor, which was awesome because I got bumped off a 2 in the morning show, which I was very happy about. Education. So this was a student-run organization, and it was supposed to break even. It did not always break even. We did not break even in my year. But we made the case to the university many times that, you know, you want to educate students. So think about who came through Eclipse and what they got out of it. And many of them learned the business of jazz and promotion. So for example, Neil and I booked the shows, but we also booked them with a third person whom we missed a lot, Don Feinberg. These people all go off into the music business and practice what they learned here. I didn't stay in the music business. I was actually a doctoral student that whole time. But the first year I learned how to run lighting from Tom. The next year, Tom wanted to do recordings, so I learned how to run lighting and design lighting from Tom. The next year, Lee twisted my arm really, really hard to run the organization with Neil, so I learned how to be a promoter. And the next year, with Scott, I learned how to do sound. And, you know, those are just cool skills. For many of us, it was cool skills. For many, many others, that became their life's careers. There was education, of course, giving education to our audience, which for us was a mission. And we did that in many ways. Of course, bringing the good music and promoting the good music so hard that people who didn't know what the music was before it was brought would go anyway and learn about new stuff. But we also did it, of course, through the printed materials, through the workshops. I'm also, you know, an amateur musician and had been my whole life and still am. And so our year we also brought things for performers. I was taking flute lessons with Andy Drellis, who was a musician in town. We brought him in to start a jam session series so that aspiring musicians had a place to learn to play with other people. We also brought an improvisation workshop that year. So we learned lots of ways. Now, the skill I learned that I had after is, of course, we had to renew those MCA and NEA grants and had to write new arts grants. Now, have I written arts grants since? No. I'm a scientist. I write for National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. But I learned how to write a grant while working for Eclipse Jazz. So that was a useful skill for me personally. Let's see. What else do I want to say? I think I've kind of covered the ground, so I'm going to pass it on.
Good evening. Thanks for coming out tonight. I'm Ann Rebentish, and I flew in from L.A. with my dog, Luca. I wanted him to be here tonight. I came to Eclipse because I was lonely. And I had seen Eclipse flyers in the co-op where I lived, and I think it was Sonny Rollins, and I had been to some concerts, and I saw that they were looking for volunteers, and I'm like, and I had also seen Lee and Mike coming down the hall of the union activities offices, and I thought, I'd like to get involved with that organization. So I did, and became the promotion coordinator and made the ads for the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press and the Ann Arbor News and the Michigan Daily with press type, which were sheets of fonts in different point sizes, and you used a burnisher, and I made some of the flyers too, and then I wanted to learn how to do a radio show. And because there was so much cross-pollinization, as everyone's talked about. And so Mike Rosorian was teaching me how to do a radio show, and he played the title track from this album by Steve Lacy called Trickles. And I had never heard that musician before, and I was so smitten. And it took me 13 years to finally meet Steve Lacy, and when I finally did, I became his manager for 5 years, and he was presented by Eclipse Jazz. It was the first gig I booked for Steve, and Eclipse presented him at the Arc in March 1989, and then Mike presented the Lacy Sextet at Spoleto Festival, and Lee presented Lacy at Frog Island and a little club in Detroit, and Oh, and Cleveland too, right? And I think that was after I was off the list then. But anyway, so it's been a lifelong group of friends that I've been in touch with over the years outside of Ann Arbor, and with Kenny in L.A. and San Francisco, Kenny Addy, who's here from Boston, and it was a lot of personal growth for me, and I was really glad to have been involved. So thank you, everybody. Thanks for all being here.
Hi, my name is Scott McQuinney, and I am very grateful to be here. It's nice to see lots of friends, and what a pleasure. I think this is a great thing. One of the things for me is that Eclipse, we did a lot of shows, and a lot of people, R. Wolf and Larry and Ann and other folks, have been compiling a list of all the shows that happened that Eclipse did from 1975 to 1993, and it's a really impressive list. It's like 10 pages of like the greatest artists of that time. So we did help, and that's not happening in Ann Arbor right now, So we really did bring something in, and we did it at a high level, and we were young. We were learning how to do that stuff. So I really appreciate the lineage that came before, the old wise ones down there, the old wise ones. Not like the young, fresh side. But no, seriously, I really did. I respected Mike Rafsorian and everybody, Lee, all you cats. I very much respected you. And I realized that I came to Ann Arbor. I was really learning just about jazz in the years before I came to Ann Arbor. I came here to go to the University of Michigan in the autumn of 1977. And so Eclipse had been up and running for a couple of years. But I very quickly, within a couple of months, became involved with Eclipse and with WCBN, both at the same time. And I learned how to do sound with Mike and Tom from Ed Learned in 1978. And we quickly put that skill to use because we did this four-day jazz festival with an amazing lineup of artists at Hill Auditorium like 3 months later. So, and we did okay. We made it happen, and we all kind of said, hey, yeah, we can do this. So now we had a sound system, and we ran with it, and it was really a fantastic time. The Jazz Festival in 79, 1980, we were kind of a bridge. The first Blues and Jazz Festival had already ended, and we created this era that led up for a number of years, and following folks will tell you more about that. But I want to say in 1979, I became the technical director of Eclipse Jazz, and at the same time I was the program director of WCBN. So I was very much this link that was happening, and the people that you see around me were all part of this. There was a dynamic vitality to what we were doing in terms of presenting music at the highest level we could, whether we were blasting it out on the airwaves or presenting it live on some really great stages, Michigan Theater Stage, Power Center Stage, Hill Auditorium Stage, U Club, Ballroom, and it was a blast. Moving forward, I took that skill set and became a professional. I learned how to do what I was doing because really there was no money. I was driving for Yellow Cab, and then I started to work at Mr. Flood's Party and Joe Star Lounge and started to do shows at WEMU and got to know Michael Jewett and Michael Nastis and Jim Dalzo and went into the Detroit Jazz Festival. I started to work that for many, many years, which was fantastic as a stage manager and sound engineer, and Everett Armstrong was involved. And so there really was a community that endeavored to do this in Ann Arbor and in greater southeastern Michigan as much as we could. Personally, moving forward, I took that skill set, and I am an audio engineer. That is what I do. I'm the audio engineer at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor, and 24 hours ago, I was running a mixing console doing live stuff. All the stuff I've picked up since 1978, I put into every show I do, and I was mixing for 800 people, 90 musicians on stage and some lead singers, and it wasn't jazz, but it was cool. So anyway, I'm one of those people who's very gainfully employed, and it was huge for me in 1978 and 79 to see, can you do this, and then come up with yes, and then, well, how far are you going to run with it? I ran with it. So I want to give a shout-out to a lot of people. There's a couple of fallen brothers, Ted Gaudet and Al Hudock, who are not on the planet anymore, but we appreciate both of them and everything that they brought. Frog Island was a big thing, and you know, those of you who remember those cats, beautiful, and I'm proud to call them friends. Also, Aerial Enterprises, Jim Lilly, and Dave Bartlebaugh, and Big Ed, and Steve Fisher, another fallen comrade, did a great job helping us out over the years. And I'm just going to do a shout-out to people like, I talked to Jeremy Loeb last week, and our friends like Andy Rob Vogel and Guido and Tony Hines. So shout out to all of you. Thank you. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Roger Kramer. Eclipse for me was one of the most important formative experiences I've had in my life, really, as a student and as a continuing music industry professional, to me, it, in many ways, it all started with Eclipse. Dialing back a little bit, when I was in high school in outside of Cleveland, I remember, and I was thinking about going to college, I had seen that Cecil Taylor had played, or was going to play in Ann Arbor. I'm thinking, oh, wow, that'd be, I want to go to school there. Cecil Taylor's playing. So that was sort of a defining moment for me where I wanted to go to college. And I was also involved in college radio when I was in high school. When I first arrived in Ann Arbor for student orientation, I literally went to the dorm room they had assigned to me, dumped my bag on the bunk, and went to WCBN and said, can I have a radio show? I mean, it was in the summer. It wasn't even school yet. But I was very fortunate. I did pick up a midnight to 3 a.m. slot or whatever it was in my first semester of my freshman year, and that was the coolest thing. And I went to, had to have been every single Eclipse show during my freshman year of college. I wasn't involved in the organization yet, but then I don't remember exactly how I was introduced to it, but my recollection is that this is an organization that was run by two tremendously charismatic guys, was Lee and Michael. And I really looked up to them and seemed like something that I wanted to do, got involved, became the promotion coordinator, I think. Eventually, I was sort of the coordinator in waiting during the 78-79 year. And it really was so incredible to be doing shows at, as everyone has made clear, an incredibly high level. Looking back, it was a high level. We were doing shows at Hill Auditorium and Residential College. We were writing grants to Michigan Council for the Arts and the NEA. And we were, I was seriously sort of painfully jazz damaged kid and student. It was my passion. I'm sure it was painful for the people around me. And like Michael, I apologize for whatever I did to anyone around me with my fanaticism. But it was like, it was literally like being a kid in a candy shop. You would sit there and go, who do I want to bring in? Wow, Philip Glass. That's a cool idea. I'll bring in Philip Glass. And people were like, Philip Glass, and that's not jazz. They're like, well, it's not rock and roll. So, and because the major events office would never let us do, you know, any rock and roll. I wanted to do Pirou, but they wouldn't let us do that. So Philip Glass, and we did a workshop with him, and it was really early on in his rise to be, you know, the giant of contemporary classical music. It was like 1979. And we were doing these sort of combination programs. And Arwolf, you'd mentioned this in some of the communication that you sent us about the Arthur Blythe opening for Sarah Vaughan, which is my idea, damn it, I think. My memory isn't that good. But the idea was to blend these, you know, more progressive performers with more traditional performers, either on the same bill if you could do it, or using the more traditional performers who sold lots of tickets to support our habit, which was like Dave Holland's solo bass, or Oliver Lake and Julius, was it Oliver Lake and Julius Semple's saxophone battles, which would drive people out of the room, right? I mean, it was so much, it was like serious professional development and more fun than I've ever had in my life was working at Eclipse Jazz. And it would transform me because you could take your musical passion, and I'll tell the story I've told many times. There was an album that I was fanatical about, 1977, Ornette Coleman's Dancing in Your Head. Yeah. Loved that album. Yeah. And there was a drummer on it. It said Shannon Jackson. Yeah. This was like 1977, 78 when the album came out. So I get a brochure in the mail from this woman. Her name was Philippa Rendell. And it said, Ronald Shannon Jackson's Decoding Society. And there was a list of 9 musicians. And I hadn't heard the music, but I recognized the name from Dancing in Your Head. And this woman calls me on the phone, and she says, you know, we wanted, you know, we're going on tour. And I said, oh, really? So all these guys are going to come? It was like Billy Bang and Bern Nix and, like, all, you know, all these heroes of the New York avant-garde. Like, they're all going to show up. She's like, oh, yeah, they're all going to come. I'm like, I'll do it. $1,500, done. So it turns out they came out. They drove out in a car. It was 4 guys. It was Vernon Reed, Melvin Gibbs, Ronald Shannon Jackson, and Byard Lancaster. And that show is where I met Vernon Reed.
Yep.
And I moved to New York in 1981 and I met Shannon Jackson. I actually served him breakfast because I was a waiter at the
stage door restaurant, and he was staying at the Bell Tower Hotel. So I met Shannon. He told me to look him up when I came to New York. I did. I became his manager. I got sick of him about 3 years later, and Vernon also got sick of him. Vernon started forming various bands, the Vernon Reed Band, Vernon Reed's Living Color, then eventually Living Color, and I managed the band Living Color for 10 years, and I stayed a music industry professional. I don't manage bands, but I'm a lawyer now. So it all started with this sort of formative experience of being in Eclipse Jazz, and I want to thank Lee and Michael, because to me, they were my inspiration.
I'm bummed to know we missed a Pear Ubu show.
Yeah.
Never,
it,
this,
let me book
it. Never happened. It's like I'm pained that that happened. It didn't happen.
Hi, I'm Larry Graham. Roger is to blame for everything for me, pretty much. And I'm just so thrilled to be on the stage with these people. You know, when I was 19, these were not human beings to me. These were really, they were gods to me. They were so important, and they were so generous. Anytime I needed anything, they were always there, and it was amazing. Graf, the way I remember the vision was you telling me that Duke Ellington is the Beethoven of our time. And that was sort of the vision statement, meaning that, if Beethoven were playing on Hill Auditorium, he'd have a good piano. Why should Duke Ellington have to play a crappy piano in the club? And that really, I use that line throughout my decade in the jazz business, but everything else. And as I was thinking about this event, there was no way, once Max actually called me, there was no way, like Roger said, I could have missed this. This was the seminal development in my life. And I came, and that mixing of styles. I bought tickets to see Dexter Gordon at the 1979 Jazz Festival because I had played tenor sax badly, second tenor sax in stage band in high school. And then Sun Ra came out of the floor. And it completely, utterly blew my mind. And I can't say at that moment I liked it. I hated it. But I had this insight that something amazing was happening, and there were 2,500 people there. It had to be good, right? It was the headliner of a big jazz festival. And and it completely changed my way of viewing the world. I'd never been exposed to it. If that was there, what else was there? And and I went and found, who's this Eclipse Jazz? I went in the first meeting, and as someone said, everyone was sitting in a circle. It was very democratic. And joints were going back and forth faster than I could deal with it. And my third week home from college, I went home. My third week of college, I went home for Rosh Hashanah, and I told my dad, Dad, I know all of my life I wanted to be a doctor, but I've changed my mind. I'm going to be a jazz promoter. And what do you know? I did. Some years later, when I was in Cleveland producing a jazz festival, I told that story to Sun Ra, and he just looked at me and said, yep, happens all the time. And I will venture to say that story was the first essay I wrote on my business school application, how Sun Ra blew my mind. And somehow Stanford liked that. I don't think they'd ever seen anything like that. So Sun Ra really has had a major influence on my life. He got me a Stanford Business School. But we were supposed to talk here about this part about the transition, the maturation. And again, thinking about what I personally got out of Eclipse, by the time I had graduated, I could have an item on my resume, no money, but an item on my resume that said I'd run an organization of 50 people, that I had written and won 4 federal grants. I mean, there's at least 3 of us on the stage who write grants for a good chunk of our living now. You know, if you're in the nonprofit field, if you can write a successful grant, you will never be unemployed, right? And so you learn that. I mean, it's just amazing. And I started in the box office. I was selling tickets. And I became the box office manager, then promotion, and, you know, then worked my way up to coordinator for a year and a half. In our year, we're leading up to Miles, by the way. I'm going to save this for this guy. But what we really tried to do in my time is we started the jazz at the U Club, which is now a fast food restaurant, which really drives me crazy because some of the best moments of my life were in that club. And the idea there was to do very high-level shows but be able to do more of them with less money. You know, we could do more shows, do fewer. The big shows took so much efforts, so much time and money. And we did, and what we did is we expanded things. We had the improv class with David Swain. We had Hayes and Schumacher do a jazz history class. We had the sound engineering class with Big Ed. So we were doing so many things, almost something every night of the week. I'm out of time. Madison.
My name is Max Dane. I got to Eclipse in 1978. Before I ever went to class at the University of Michigan, I may be exaggerating a little bit. Well, first let me say, before I went to class, I met a fellow named Jim Grant. Jimmy's not here tonight. He's a dear friend, and I wish he was, because what I learned from him and from so many others. Jimmy kind of talked to me about what Eclipse was. I was practicing my trumpet at the student union, and I think Jimmy was like a senior guide who helped new students find their way around the University of Michigan, and he helped me find my way to Eclipse Jazz. And I desperately wish I would have prepared, but in any event, I want to share another random thought, which is Rick Kagan's not here tonight either, and Rick meant a lot to me. Rick is a dear friend, a terrific guy, and both Jimmy and Rick and this stage full of people and others kind of personified the level of really national caliber excellence in terms of the peers that we had the privilege of learning from and befriending for a lifetime. I say that as I'm looking at Lee Berry or as I could look at Michael or whatever. That means a lot to me. I became familiar with the music as a trumpet player. Someone helped me to hear Miles Davis playing Gingerbread Boy on the Miles Smiles recording. And as a trumpet player, what I lacked in talent, I made up for with a very poor work ethic. So there was never any danger, never any danger of me doing that for a living. But I did hear it. I really heard it. And I'll never forget the opening statement of Mary Lou Williams at the 1978 Jazz Festival when I sat down to hear that music. And I will never, so long as I live, forget Johnny Griffin and Dexter Gordon playing Blues Up and Down. When I was 14 years old, I went to see the Rolling Stones, and they just blew the house apart. And I knew that feeling of utter and absolute exhilaration that magnificent music can take you to. And that night when Johnny Griffin and Dexter Gordon just blew Hill Auditorium up with Blues Up and Down, I experienced that again, and it changed me. It changed the way I heard things. It changed the way I perceived things. And that's the thing about Eclipse Jazz. There was this, people have mentioned it on and on and on, our sense of like national caliber artistry. And I felt like I had the opportunity to learn from people who would go on in their lives to contribute in various fields at a national level of accomplishment. And that is precious beyond words. That sense of that level of performance. And I, too, remember Michael Grafsorian talking about the Bachs and the Beethovens of our time who must and should and will be provided the same kind of platform that we provide and the same respect and the same careful curating vision that the European arts are provided. And that was a big deal. I had something else to say, and it completely flew out of my mind. So, oh, Miles Davis, I'm sorry, of course. So, enough about Miles, a little more about me. But my trumpet playing. So at any rate, in 1981, I came to run the organization as a coordinator. I came to run the organization. I think nobody else raised their hand, and there I was. And that summer, Miles Davis came out of retirement. And I can't tell you what that meant to me personally. I never thought I was going to hear him play. And then word came that he was going to be working at Avery Fisher at George Ween's Festival, and we went. And Al Hudock, that Larry, thank you for mentioning Al and his brother. We climbed into a van, put our pennies together, bought the gas, and got to hear Miles Davis play at Avery Fisher Hall. I got back to Ann Arbor. I sat down in front of Bob Davies, and I said, Bob, I've got to present Miles Davis. And I kind of carefully worked out my little offer sheet. You know, it was $25,000 and, you know, this and that and the other. Bob looked at it. He was having a bad day. He crumpled it up, and he threw it at me. And I think I shared this with Lee in an email. I just wouldn't leave his office until he said yes. I didn't know what else to do. I'm not going to do this and be the guy that didn't produce Miles Davis. That's not going to happen. And so Larry and I both had the opportunity to stand outside of Miles' dressing room. It's a corny memory, but I'll share it. And as I listened to him warm up, I just didn't know what to do with myself. I mean, I didn't think that I would ever hear that. And Miles Davis was in that dressing room getting ready to perform. I saw Michael get up. I didn't see the light go off, so I presume that it's done. But at any rate, Miles had decided to play in Detroit, unfortunately, a month before our show. This was after we booked the show. But it undersold a little bit. Maybe there was 2,500 people at Hill Auditorium instead of the 4,000 that I promised Davies there would be. But that seems so trivial now. Because we also presented Ornette Coleman in February of 1982. And it just so happened that the night before, Thelonious Monk had passed away. And Ornette came out. We obviously took a moment to remember Thelonious Monk and what he'd given us. And then Ornette came out. And more than the music that he played that night is the workshop that he provided that day, which was, again, I think I've used the word before, but it was completely and absolutely, utterly incoherent. I have no idea what he was talking about, and I walked out of there deeply moved. I mean, I just remember somebody asking him what harmonics meant, and 15 minutes later, I had no idea. But at any rate, I want to, again, as I just want to echo others' gratitude for those that I can't remember as I'm sitting here and those that I'm looking at. You changed my life in ways that I don't have words to express. And I am so grateful for the opportunity that I personally had and the work that we were able to do together. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Is that working?
Yeah.
My name's Sam Kaufman, and I was coordinator. I was with Eclipse from 86 to 89. Like fall 86 to spring 89 when I graduated. And I was only at University of Michigan for 3 years. I started my life as a music major at North Texas State playing the drums, and music was always a really important part of my life. But when I left music school and I decided I didn't want to do that, I was looking for some way to get in the music industry. And I had fished around right after leaving music school, and I did a brief stint at Galen Rice Talent Agency during that summer between Texas and Ann Arbor. And that didn't work out so well. And I basically ended up getting a job at Radio Shack for that summer. And so when I got to Michigan, I was living in a big house with a friend of mine who played guitar, who had actually been in music school with me. And he, actually, Lee, I never told you this, I think he knew your brother, Pat Berry, and that was the connection through Troy. His name is Don Ambori, and he basically said you should check out Eclipse Jazz because this is where, you know, you're going to learn about the music industry, and this is going to be your best route. And from the moment I heard about that, and actually, it didn't rent out right away, but as soon as I went to the first meeting and I saw the high level that this organization was operating at, which a bunch of people have mentioned, it's like I was totally driven from that point, and I knew I had to be involved in this organization. I knew that this was going to be my future. And, I mean, I got exposed to music that I was never exposed to before. I think the first show I saw with Eclipse was the World Saxophone Quartet, and that was just dramatically different from anything I had ever heard before. I mean, to hear these four saxophone players making rhythm with no rhythm section, and just really blew me away. But then I saw all these volunteers were involved and so like committed to it and dedicated, and then something in me just said, okay, I have to. I think I started out as a promotion director or coordinator, whatever the position was called back then, and started doing that. But then pretty quickly I said, I have to run this organization. I have to be involved with booking these concerts. I have to learn how this works. I have to really, you know, it became my mission. And I remember I was talking with Lee about this before, that there was sort of a recently formed advisory board, I think, during the year I started. And the process for selecting a coordinator, I think, was a little more organized than maybe it had been in other years. But there was actually a little application I got handed. And I remember typing up the application and being very diligent about it, and then sitting around a big board table with a bunch of the board members who were kind of interviewing me and deciding if I should be part of this organization. And I was just really happy to have been selected as one of the co-coordinators. And I think CC Helgeson was a co-coordinator with me in the beginning. And I loved it. And I immediately, I'm sitting in the Eclipse office, and I start getting these calls from agents in New York, you know, who know what Eclipse is, have heard of, and because of everything you guys did. And actually, this is the first thing I wanted to say, is that you guys, everybody on this panel created this organization, and I'm sort of the baby that came out of it, you know? Like, you guys, you gave birth to me because of Eclipse. I learned so much about the industry. So I'm sitting in the Eclipse office, and these agents are calling, and they're like, this is a really important organization, and you're the coordinator now, and you should know that, and, you know, you need to know about these artists. And they became part of my education, because they would tell me about, you know, what was happening in jazz and what was important. And I learned about, you know, Lester Bowie and the Art Ensemble of Chicago. We were talking about Marty Kahn last night, one of the managers who represented the Art Ensemble of Chicago. And, you know, he is a character, you know, and he's still around. He's in the business. And so I did this for a semester, which in my mind later, as I was filling out this questionnaire for Our Wolf, it was, you know, it became a year. I was like, oh, I did this for 2 years. No, I didn't do it for 2 years. I did it for two semesters. But it was just so rich and educational for me personally, both musically and, you know, as a professional, and what I ultimately became as a professional. Because as soon as I finished with Eclipse and as soon as I graduated, I immediately went to New York and I began working with jazz artists, and I began working with the exact kind of musicians that Eclipse stood for and Eclipse was famous for. And one of the shows, I did Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy, I did Dewey Redman with his, I think it was a trio back then. I think it was a trio because we couldn't afford the quartet, so we got the trio. But the trio was actually really great. And then we did a workshop with Dewey. And I was thinking about this, that Dewey was, I really felt a connection with Dewey. Sorry, I'm going to go too long now. But I'm the last one, so it doesn't matter. So Dewey was a big motivation to move to New York. I worked with Pharoah Sanders, Elvin Jones, Don Pullen. I went on like a big South American tour with the Don Pullen Trio. One of the first things I did in New York when I got there, I was there in 89, but in 1991, I booked this 30-city bus tour with Henry Threadgill and his Very Very Circus group. And that was kind of the first big tour I'd done. I'd done lots of little stuff before that, but that was the first sort of major extended thing. And I traveled out to a bunch of those shows to see it firsthand. And then I went to Japan a couple times with an Art Blakey tribute group that had a bunch of alum from Art Blakey and a John Coltrane memorial group. And through one of those tours, I connected with a record company in Japan and was able to produce an album with the Art Blakey tribute band, and that became the first album I ever produced. And then I also did another album with Tom Harrell, album called Labyrinth. So I really got, like, through the work I did with Eclipse, I became all these things that Eclipse stood for, and without Eclipse, it never would have happened. It never would have occurred to me to do this, and I had a very different concept of what jazz was. I knew I wanted to be in the music industry, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And because of the education I got through Eclipse and through all of you, and I would be, you know, remiss if I didn't mention Larry, because one of the first people to call me in the office was Larry. And Larry was running the Tri-C Jazz Festival. And he just randomly called the office and said, you know, you're the new coordinator of Eclipse, and I want to be your mentor. I want to be available to you as a resource. And that meant the world to me, and that just really made a difference. And he was a mentor, you know, throughout my professional life. And we're not always in touch as much now because we're doing different things, but, you know, you really meant a lot to me, Larry. And this whole organization meant a lot to me.
Okay. Hi, everyone. So my name is Kenny Addy. I was with Eclipse in 77 and 78. I just wanted to say something about the future, maybe, and what Eclipse can mean to maybe a college education and what we all took out of being at Michigan and how we seem to remember Eclipse as this important part of our education and the only reunion we would ever go to. I have a daughter who's just got accepted to the University of Michigan, but she hasn't quite decided whether to come here or not. She has until May 1st. So the question is sort of, what is it that, you know, let's say my daughter is interested in music and dance and theater and is doing all these things, but obviously she's going to come to university and do other things and may or may not take advantage of those, you know, of the arts that the university may have to offer. But something like Eclipse is exactly the kind of organization that she would, you know, would be the best part of her education potentially, and things that she could carry into the future with her when she leaves, like all of us did. And it's not there, or is it? I'm sure University of Michigan has other things, and other universities do too. But wouldn't that have been a shame if it wasn't there for us when we went to school? So maybe how groups like this are really a necessary part of that college experience. It is, if you want to comment on it.
I would comment that I learned something today about Suzanne Young and her vision. And I think she was and is a remarkable woman. And I now feel more remarkable having heard that it was on her radar that she was talking to Jimmy. She was forward-thinking enough to say, get up there to East Lansing. She was paying attention and making effort and showing interest. And I think universities, I don't know, maybe Lee probably knows better than I do, but the idea of students participating in something other than classroom activities is not a revolutionary idea. It's been around college life for a long time. It really gets down to, are there people like Suzanne Young who are professionals, university staff, and do they see the value in it, and will they do something about it? And so my hat's off to Suzanne Young. So to address, Kenny, what you were saying, I think it's, I guess when you're shopping around for college, it should be on the list.
Kenny? Can I just briefly follow your question up? I'm sorry, I lost track of. Hi, Kenny. I wanted to briefly follow up your question with a question, and I guess I would direct it to Michael and Lee and Jimmy. If Eclipse were to happen today, and it's difficult for us, we're over 50 years old at this point, but if a 20, 21, 22-year-old person were to start something like this today, substantively, artistically, what would it be about? I mean, that was a moment that jazz was an obvious, or at least certainly a valid answer to that question. I just wonder what it would be about from where you guys sit today.
Well, I think
that's ahead, a Jim. Really good question. You know, the other night, my daughter's a junior here at Michigan, and I was out to dinner with a group of her friends. And they kind of indulged me. Maybe it was because I was picking up the check, but they tell some stories about what this organization was about. And just also, too, earlier than that, I've been kind of on the periphery of the music scene in Detroit growing up. And, I think it's funny, what I do now, what I run an organization, and it's a nonprofit, and it's really for enrichment to in New York, but to give students, undergrads, graduate students, professionals in their first job who are kind of like we all were. It's an incredibly diverse group, too. Great. All the things you're not going to learn in a classroom. And I don't know. Today, I think that it's really kind of on them to determine. You know, I think there is a lot. There is, again, like I mentioned this idea. There is a kind of an ethos of DIY, do it yourself. I do think, though, at the academic level, you know, when I see what's happened across from, you know, East Quad, I was at the residential college, and that business school is so huge. It just keeps getting bigger, you know, the morphing. Taking over the university. I think, and to Michael's point, I think that it's the students kind of demanding it, and that it seems that they're so focused on professionalism and education's gotten so expensive that it's just kind of saying, okay, this is what we're interested in. Whether it's I'm not sure, whether it's jazz, whether it's electronica or hip-hop or an amalgam of all that, I'm not sure. But it's... The spark should be lit and just kind of know that thing of youth that you can just kind of do it and ask, you know, ask for it, ask for the means, ask for the reins. Yet it should be the responsibility of an institution like this to kind of light the fuse.
Yeah, I think you need to not look at what's at the University of Michigan or wherever you might go. I mean, because what's going to be helpful to anybody is what isn't there in what you build.
Yeah.
So you just want to find a place that is a good enough environment where that can happen. And then hopefully you'll be lucky and a Suzanne will come and say you need to go to the ballroom committee, and then Jimmy Robbins will be there, and then other people will be there, and it will happen. But you just need a place that will allow that to happen. And I think there's a lot of places.
Well, but there was a market for it.
Yeah, we hit point. Jazz at a really good time.
That's the point.
We hit jazz when, like, Dexter Gordon came from Copenhagen and said, hey, here. And he loved it here. So I want to know from Lee Berry, because you book shows, what are you seeing? What shows do University of Michigan people come out to? What do you think the possibilities are? Because we're talking different genres. I think it's... I don't follow it that much, but I think it may be obvious that jazz isn't as accepted as it was. We hit it in a sweet spot.
Exactly.
Okay? Exactly. What's today? I don't know. You see it on the ground. You see the market. What's the market
today? So I do see the market.
Just to point out that voice you heard talking during Neil, that's the library saying they're closing in 15 minutes. Okay. We have to get out of here, start packing up probably in about 5. So,
I'm just going to say that I don't really book shows anymore, but I do pay attention. Okay, I have a different role as a development director nowadays, but I pay attention, and I think that it's worth noting that actually the work that we've done all these years actually does continue. It's in a different, it's called a fragmented kind of a way, but I see Mark Jacobson here from the University Musical Society, who brings a lot of great jazz shows to our town. Carytown Concert House brings a lot of jazz shows to our town. The Edge Fest is a great event that happens. SEMJA does work. WEMU does work. So there's a lot of things going on. The ARC as well. And I would love it if it was even more. I think that I'd love to see an effort made to try to recruit young people to be interested again, because I think that it's not 1975, but there's great music being made, and I think that there are people who would get involved and be that bridge that someone mentioned earlier between the music and the audience.
Can I use this mic?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, the point I was making in the introduction about the right people, all of you, and give yourselves, I mean, credit here. I mean, it was your, you know, dedication to this that kept it going, that made it happen. You know, the place has changed. Ann Arbor now is not, it's not the way it used to be. It's a different play. I'm not dogging Ann Arbor now. There was no internet in 1975. You know, people, if you wanted to do something, you had to go somewhere and listen to it. And I just think that the world has really, really changed. The digital imprint on the real world. Now I sound like some, you know, tech. Welcome to the Michael Jewett TED Talk, which is going to end right now. But I think you made a great point, Larry.
The whole world of jazz is different. You don't have any. You don't have major labels selling a million copies of anybody. It was the first time last year no one sold a platinum album in any style of music. I mean, not even Taylor Swift. Nobody did. But back when you guys started, Weather Report was, you know, those were gold records. You know, I mean, Dexter Gordon was on a major label. You had all these young lions on RCA, on Columbia. It's a different time. Woody Shaw, thank you, on Columbia. You had all these. Yeah, Arthur Blythe was on Columbia, you know. And I just think that the... Yeah, right. You know, I don't want to discourage your daughter from going out there and doing it. She's going to have to invent it. Let Michael have one quick last word.
All right, thanks. I've been curating for 35 years after Eclipse and producing concerts in South Carolina. I now represent about 16 musicians. It's true the world has changed, the digital world and so forth, but I will say two things. The music has continued to evolve. Okay, so where we were in 1976 is not where the world is today. There's a 21st century is a very, very exciting time for music worldwide. It may not seem like it sometimes in the United States, but I can tell you globally it really is. So there's fresh, amazing material in Europe and South America that people just don't know about. So I would sit your daughter down in my place, and I'd play music for the both of you. Spin your heads for 3 hours, no problem. That's one thing. The second thing is that, yes, the distribution of music has changed, and you used to be forced to go out. But I submit, nothing's changed about sitting together and being moved by a live performance. Nothing has changed.
Again, your Eclipse panel.